This is my journey, inspired one story at a time. A library of leaders was created. It began as a journey to learn. As time went on, it began to grow. All it needed was a platform, and this podcast was created to listen, to inspire, to share. I am a storyteller, and this is my journey. Welcome to another episode in Profiles in Leadership. I am your host, Steve Anderson, and our guest today is Mark Morey. Mark is a human connection specialist. He works with executives and leaders with fiscal agency who are struggling with strategic approaches to the complexity of burnout and isolation in the workforce. We talk a lot about how we are built for connections to culture, community, each other, and ourselves. Mark has an impressive background and brings a real holistic approach to leadership development and designing company cultures. He has offered to all of you listening today a program called Five to Thrive, five actionable connection techniques that scale and transform your culture. The link to this is in the show summary and can be found at Mark Morey, that's markmorey.lpages.co. Mark is a fascinating individual and thinks really deep and gets into these concepts that make a lot of sense. So really enjoyed our discussion today. So let's just jump right into it. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program. It's great to have you today.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
So let's start with giving our listeners your experience in leadership and leadership development.
All right. Well, the last 15 years or so, I've been working in the tech field for some reason, even though my background has been in more education and community development. But I've been working in Nike this past year and Google. So it's been quite a journey from bringing leadership development ideas that were really born from how do we raise healthy children, how do we develop leadership and community into the workplace, because we realized, oh, it's not just community that needs this. Workplaces are community. So that's the transition I made. So that's been my background. I had corporate Outward Bound experience years ago. I did five or so years of traveling in Europe, working for them, and Boston, Thompson Island, Outward Bound, corporate work, and started building my chops there around facilitation and all the human aspects that are underneath corporate leadership all the time. So that's some of my background.
And I've always been real intrigued with Outward Bound. So what is their mission and how successful do you think that program is?
Well, Boston, each center is a bit different. There's an international group that's tying together the brand. I don't remember how many are in the U.S. It could be 20 or 30 centers. So each one has a bit of autonomy. And the one in Boston is pretty cool because it's on an island in the harbor. So they serve basically two audiences, youth at risk, because the history of Thompson Island was of a boarding school for wayward boys way back in the day, and also a corporate audience as a retreat space to get out of the city in the opposite direction, straight out into the water and have this great nature reflection experience. So they built a high ropes course and all that kind of stuff. I would say that, you know, if you track leadership development, you know, team building and ropes course work got super big in, I don't know, the 80s and 90s. And I think it was super experiential and a big step from maybe more prescriptive, drier training programs. And the transfer that was going on for people to really meaningful things was quick, very embodied, immediate insights. But I think what I realized over time is that the limitation on that is the out of context learning environment. So I'm a fan of having two major aspects of a transformational leadership program. One is immersive experiences, and the other complementary aspect is the integration, or what you might say, chop wood, carry water, of the practice to implement what the deeper insight was. So I don't know how well those translated into everyday work in terms of long-term transformation. So that's kind of where I started exploring other methodologies that could deepen that.
Yeah, and why do you believe that team building is so effective when done outdoors? What's the out in nature part of all that?
I mean, that's a really good question, because you could just do this indoors, right? Which I have done. I've been influenced by, I don't know, perhaps my childhood or certain coincidences that led me into outdoor leaders and teachers, that says that human beings basically have co-evolved with the natural world for a long time. And I hold some strong premises that without a long-term relationship to the natural world, like right from the get-go, that we're actually lacking a certain important aspect of human development. So, you know, there is a responsibility aspect of stewarding the natural world in terms of sustainability, but I think there is a being state and an intelligence that actually grows when we exercise our relationship with nature. You know, in the same sense, like, you know, those studies that were really appalling back in the 50s and 60s, where if you removed a child from their mother, or, you know, the mother had no emotional connection to the child, the child started freaking out because they had a lack of context for their emotional intelligence, and they were really losing a sense of self, and it created some really deep anxiety and panic. I have a sense that human beings are to nature in the same way, that we've really headed indoors. If you had a childhood like mine, you got to spend a lot of it outdoors because there wasn't that much interesting stuff on TV and computers didn't exist. You ran around outside at night.
Right.
You played with your friends and you got experientially involved. But more and more children are spending time indoors, and we're seeing kind of the long-term unconscious survey come back with a lot of attention deficit disorder issues. We have obesity issues. We have lack of social connection issues. And of course, a lot of self-esteem issues when it comes to online bullying and teen suicide. So there's a lot of indicators that something's not going well. I think a big piece of it is we're taking away fundamental nourishment. So if you put a training environment, a learning environment, outdoors, we're already a step ahead in terms of relaxing and, you know, working with our biology that's open and receptive to what the next kind of growth moment is for us. That's my thinking.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, in a previous discussion, you mentioned that leadership development is really developing the whole person. So take us a little deeper into that idea. So by the whole person, is that kind of including this outdoor existence as well, and so dive into that a little bit deeper.
Yeah, developing the whole person. There's when we look at childhood development, I think we have a sense that each child is born uniquely. Do you have kids, Steve?
I do. I have three adult children at this point. They're all grown up, but I do have three.
Yeah, and maybe still growing.
Yes, always.
Right. And this is kind of what I'm getting at. There's two aspects to this, but it's more observable in children. I think it's even kind of more acceptable in our society to really kind of grasp onto that, you know, you want to apply the same parenting approaches to your kids, but they don't work. You know, you have to start adjusting yourself, and you'd love to just have a program that you could run them all through. But here comes the next one throwing you a curveball, and you have to, you know, really wake up to it, because they're getting annoyed, or there's friction, or, you know, you're not paying attention.
And they're just all very different. They're all very different in the way they approach
things. They're all very different.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not that they're different. I think it's they're being them, their unique self.
Right.
So if that's the case, you know, you could say this is a principle of a living system, that everything has a uniqueness. We could call it its essence. Kind of like its essentialness. And the second aspect of that is it doesn't necessarily develop or is welcomed or is grown into its potential, especially with how it fits in with the whole, either the family or community or larger society. So you can think of the academic world and the education world that kind of moves you into boxes. Maybe you're like this, we'll typecast you. Maybe you're like that. Maybe you're like this personality trait, and then this career would be good for you. Now, that's not thinking of adults from the place of everyone's one of one. It starts to categorize them as if they're not all unique. So what would it be like if we continued human development in the workplace as a whole approach of how to engage people in their self-understanding and provide roles that express that? So as opposed to skill development or function development, this is a quality of originality. And, that would include things like, what is their purpose with the system they're in? So in a business setting, there's an overall business strategy. They have a role and they're applying their unique self to the role. What is a higher aim or a purpose that you feel called to bring to this relationship? These are aspects of whole person development that don't sound like typical leadership functionality training.
And speaking of that, how we're all uniquely different and so on, how does someone like yourself who struggled in the traditional college education world find their way into the business world and contribute as a leader?
Yeah. When you say struggled, I think we could say that was code for dropped out.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about that experience and how.
Well, have you ever heard of this quote? Have you ever heard of this quote, adapting to an unwell world is no sign of health?
Yeah.
So I think one of my original qualities or unique qualities is a kind of refusal to go along with that which is unwell. And so it's a restraint. And yet, when I was young, I didn't quite understand what that gift was. It seemed like a burden. But later on, I learned it was kind of a quest for integrity. It was a quest for being in a learning environment that honored different uniquenesses, and it required a different level of awareness and consciousness of the facilitators. So that led me to, when I dropped out of college, I ended up re-enrolling in art school, and I found myself in a department that was quite creative and it was almost like a creative education learning environment, more than a medium environment like painting or sculpture. And the founder of it was highly influenced by A.S. Neal, who was a founder of the Summerhill program over in Europe that had radically new ideas about how to educate children, that had personal agency, like the youth's personal agency at the center of the process. So that really influenced me a lot. And my artwork ended up being the deep question of, how do we facilitate environments that creates optimal learning for everybody while creating a cohesive whole, meaning like the group is not fractured because of that, but it's stronger. And that correlated with how the natural world is continually reconciling differences, right? Different species have niches between species and amongst them, like different kinds of trees, different kinds of plants, different kinds of animals and birds, and they're all interacting in local ecologies in this profound, continually reconciling way. So I spent a lot of time learning about the natural world from a leadership perspective, but also just from a catching up with myself, like, wow, what would it be if I was a human being that could thrive in my natural environment, knowing where my food came from and water and how to build a shelter and navigate without a compass and understand the medicine and the things that come from plants. And also, all these things were really stimulating a sense of how to be really facile with the actual world I lived in. And then started creating organizations to help communities to build that into foundational human development in schools and organizations. And that was a nonprofit I started. So I was an executive director for 7 years of an organization called Vermont Wilderness School. And then after 7 years of that, I was thinking we needed to create systems for leadership development so that this idea can grow. So I started a for-profit called the Institute for Natural Learning and created leadership development amongst all of these other organizations that desired to bring nature, connection, and leadership into communities. And that did that for many years and end up supporting and developing some 50-some organizations nationally. And then we went over to Europe and started organizing over there. So ultimately, being an international movement leader, you could say, for restoring humans' relationship to the earth, we were focusing on childhood and human development and all the structures around it, which was culture. And that was reminiscent of the culture development I was doing in art school, because I was actively working on creating spaces that improved learning back before UI was a thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Back before we had user design. And that's exactly what I was doing. And then later on, I was like, oh, we need to do that at the community level, which includes not just children going to classes, but parents learning how to be conscious parents. And then many other community roles that start to pay attention to all the other needs that are going on in the environment. So that might include people who are responsible for adolescent transitions and becoming specialists in that rite of passage, essentially, that helps guide youth into being a good citizen, and a set of practices and relationships that guide them into healthy self-learning. That was a common thing. So that was my foundation that led me to consider, wow, we've been doing this internationally, but you know, one of the things that are, it's really influencing all these communities is spouses and other community members who are working in companies and organizations that didn't have this. In fact, they were jealous that their kids were having such an enriched life. They're like, could you do this for us? And I basically had the transferable skill set to bring this bundle of unusual nature, culture, and leadership offerings into the workplace. And I think I was ahead of my time in a sense. Like, no one really could wrap their mind around how nature was going to improve people's performance. But now, if you look at what the pandemic has cracked open for us, you can see that people are starving for connection, and isolation is a real thing, and lack of autonomic nervous system regulation is a real thing. And so my offerings actually had, you know, great context and utility, and they still do in recovering from burnout and all of the challenges we've been having.
Yeah, it's fascinating when you think, we just had this discussion the other day about education, and with your expertise in this, it seems like, you know, the traditional education is focused so much on, you know, skills and achievements and, you know, standardized testing and things like this. And yet the emotional intelligence side of that education has been waning for sure. And I know that there's some districts now and some school districts around the country that are implementing emotional intelligence training into every subject and making that every bit as important as the analytical part of education, which I think would be a good thing and kind of talks to what you just discussed.
I heard something also that was startling, and this has been trending for a long time, where teachers are having to do more human development work rather than teaching classes. So you have youth who are showing up who have been lacking parenting, have been lacking emotional development, and that is way more fundamental than learning about the curriculum of the day. So teachers, without getting higher paid positions, are having to bring in all this other capacity building. And one of the ones I've been tracking is this thing called trauma-informed education. Have you heard about this?
I have not. Tell us about it.
Well, teachers are getting trained in how to interpret children's behavior through the lens of trauma. And, you know, most people, if they're not familiar with this, interpret trauma as a blunt trauma or physical trauma, right, where you have a bruise or an injury. But there is developmental trauma that happens when children's needs aren't met. So that might look like, lack of emotional connection, or parents who are struggling really hard and the children have to figure stuff out on their own before they're supposed to. And so that they skip ahead and miss whole areas of, let's say, childhood play or a sense of belonging or a sense of safety. And when that's rocked at a fundamental level, they develop mechanisms to survive, and they do. But then they become really bad habits later on when they have to continue adapting and socializing as adults. So it ends up looking like people are really aloof, or they're really clingy, or they're very aggressive to get their needs met, even though they're not in that survival situation anymore. It becomes wired in there. And you can see this in, type A corporate executives, this kind of behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just fascinating to see that this is the question mark in my back of my mind is like, why do we need to educate teachers on trauma-informed education? You know, and that and that's part of why I think culture is an important instrument for leadership development. We can't ignore the context. If we're in such an unwell world that we have to, be paying attention to developmental trauma, then there is this issue in the system. If we only focus on individuals, then we can problematize them,
right.
Oh, this child a problem. We need to arrest that chaos and put them in detention or make a special program. But what if it's the whole system and we track that change over time? Well, you can see McKinsey's tracking stuff like that, and Harvard Business Review is tracking stuff like that in corporations. If we were learning about this before the pandemic, that people are experiencing isolation at work, when we worked in the buildings together.
Right.
Why is that? What's going on there? And so I just feel that we have a huge opportunity here to, when we say the whole human, we're including caring for all sorts of different developmental needs besides accomplishment and task-oriented things, which is a high bar. But this is where we spend a lot of our time these days. Right, in the workplace.
And we need training in it. It's not, not everyone can naturally just get into that world. So I think our training of future leaders and adolescents and everyone, the more training we can put into that, I think would be better for the long haul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I could be speaking to managers right now, right? Do you have managers listen to this podcast?
Yes. Uh-huh.
I think they're probably nodding their head like, uh-huh, yeah, I'm supposed to get a task done from my higher-ups, but there's all this other stuff there.
Right, right.
I'm managing people's, breakdowns,
yeah.
People's complaints, people's emotional outbursts, people's reactivity. They're not trained for that. So I think we can put both of those things on the table. Like I said before, I think we could have an immersion experience offline, which I've done a lot of, where we could do retreat, and now it's probably a good time to hire someone to do a nature-based retreat. That's not just a vacation, but we're actually working on leadership development, and then bring these practices back into the workplace as part of workflow, where we can apply the things that we're learning and actually build an upward spiral of, it's like strategic and transformational at the same time.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. So let's jump into the burnout issue and anxiety in the workplace. Both seem to be getting, it's almost to the breaking point levels. So what's going on and what do we need to do about it?
Yeah, I think this is the Wild West right now. And I think it's much bigger than, most executives and managers have been on a rapidly rolling wheel of change. I know a lot of leaders who run organizations, and they are flying by the seat of their pants for 16 months.
Yeah,
one thing they were allowed to do one day is now shut down. Now, up in Ontario, they went into a shutdown as we were all opening up. Six weeks of shutdown, and they just were like, "Oh, I was just ramping up for like my offerings in the summertime." And now they're like, "Do they employ their staff? Do they lay them off? Is the government going to help them? Are the government going to leave them dry?" And then there's the women in the workplace aspect, where disproportionately moms said, "Okay, I'll volunteer to be with my children," and have been disproportionately affected in their career paths. If you look at the data, it's really intense. 20-30% of women are not making it back to work. So that's something that's unreconciled still. And I think the upside of it all is that it was already becoming a problem. And now there's language for it. You know, they're coming up with language called languishing and subcategories of burnout. So, for example, I read this HBR review of the nuances of it. Like, one of the aspects of burnout might look like a self-esteem drop. And one of them might look like kind of a despondence, like a caring despondence. And another one might look like, more classically, of their nerves being fired too much. You know, their adrenal glands are a little burnout. Because the truth is, people actually worked longer hours when they went to remote, which is crazy. You know, that was a terrible equation. They're afraid they're going to lose their jobs. Lots of people got laid off, and so they worked 12 hours a day on Zoom. A lot of them were meetings. We were trying to figure out stuff. So, you know, people survive, right? But the impact of that is not going away. So I saw this really incredible research around investment. How many executives knew this was a challenge or a problem, and how much did they invest in it? It was something like 80% knew it was a challenge, but only 7% proactively invested in it.
Wow.
Meaning, yeah. And so now they're like, what are you going to do now? And they're like, we're going to reverse that number. So I expect huge budgets being applied towards not just leadership development training as we've known it, but this future of work where we proactively are creating community and appropriately value human capital, because, you know, this is one of the most priceless things that people have is the knowledge capital and the human capital in an organization. It's so expensive to replace people, and it's what your secret sauce is most of the time. And the markets are kind of demanding that kind of competition. We have to find value somewhere else besides just growth.
Yeah, and on a previous episode of this podcast, talking with another individual, he was talking about with burnout, it's kind of like people, they think they need to be more isolated then, and they need to move away from things when they're burnt out, when in reality, maybe what they need is more interaction with people and get away from the screens and get away from the Zooms and get away from those isolation things where they actually maybe need more community at that time.
Well, this was the thing that was interesting at this article series around burnout, was that they said that prescribed solutions from managers and bosses are pretty much all failing. And what's rising, which is great, I think, because this is a fundamental philosophy I have anyway, what's rising is the only solution and the best solution that's occurring to people is giving that personal agency to the person themselves to solve their challenge, which is different than happy hour Fridays on Zoom.
Right.
Or prescribing, we're going to bring in a dance person or a hula person or a craft making thing on Wednesday afternoons. It's like a whole bunch of the people don't need that, but they show up anyway and they're just annoyed. So the developmental approach would be, and this is something I think Google's pretty advanced around a lot of this stuff. And so in the engineering world, so they're a little behind, like in Nike, I was in the engineering department and they never got any leadership development at all. So these were strange ideas, and it was typically unfunded by the org of how to develop humans in tech. But Google's better at that. So we're ramping up to a multi-year process where we're going to have immersive quarterly events, and then bi-weekly or every twice a month, cohorts coming together and working on a set of frameworks and reflective inquiries around several aspects of who they are. One is, you know, a whole view of themselves, what their leadership goals are within the group that they're a part of, what the aim of the group is in your division. So there's often like an identity that we're serving some other aspect of Google, like making tools for other engineers, and being in alignment with the strategy. But the division itself is investing in people's self-understanding, and then people can start to self-manage. So it's a powerful I mean, if I could elaborate just for a second so you can image what this might be like. Imagine a series of reflections that no one is actually prescribing to you what the answers are, but they're creating an environment for you to sit with the question. I can't tell you how uncommon reflection is in the business world. It's so uncommon that when I ask a good question, people are just like, wow, I came into this meeting, meaning a training session with me, kind of resisting this, like, I don't have time for it. It's going to be another thing. I'm going to leave with more to-do lists. And what I actually did was I caught up with myself. And it's like getting fresh air. And I'm starting to realize, oh, there's a whole bunch of stuff I need to work on that I've been denying. And that's a positive that's going to change everything that I've been struggling with at a core level. So it's like working at a deeper place that regenerates multiple areas of their workflow and relationships. And it just doesn't end at 5 o'clock. It affects their parenting and their leadership and their community because it's the same leader that we're working with.
Right. And I think it's interesting how different people just have very unique and different ways of doing things to either reflect or to re-energize or whatever it may be. The example I always think of is I'm a very social person. At the end of a busy, active day, they want to decompress by going to happy hour and calling as many friends as they can to join them.
Yeah.
And then
right.
You get a real introvert and they need an hour or two to just be by themselves and regenerize that way. So it's interesting that one approach does not solve it for all. That's for sure.
Right. The catchphrase would be something like personal agency is restorative.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good.
I mean, I have a question for you. You've interviewed a lot of people. Why is that? Why is that? I'm going to say threatening. Why? And it conflicts with the other belief that most managers and executives want their employees to be self-managing. That's pretty common. Like, that would be great instead of coming to me all the time, right?
Right.
But there's an aspect of personal agency that's threatening if you actually fostered it.
Well, if you're asking my opinion, I think it goes back to we're still afraid that if we don't treat everyone the same, then we're going to develop, jealousies or HR issues or you allowed this person to do that, not that person, whatever. And I'm a huge believer that every person is unique and you can't treat everybody the same. You just have to find ways to energize them and motivate them and do things that work for them. And what works for that person doesn't always work for the other person. So I think a good leader knows what their people need and how they function, and then finding ways to maximize that so that their gifts can be brought out in different ways. And you shouldn't be uncomfortable with treating somebody differently than someone else. Talk a little bit about, all cultures throughout history have had kind of rituals and community gatherings. And are we losing this as we evolve as humans?
There's a leap. I have a lot to say about that. I think you know. But I'm holding in my mind the business context. But in general, are we losing this? In certain subcultures, and I would say, in the United States, there's definitely been a trend away from stable, intact, connected communities. I just know that firsthand. That, for example, if you took little indicators and you want to do some testing, what communities in this country or this part of this country or around the world still have their parents, their aging parents, live with the family until they die? And you can get that pulse, and you can see the transition that cultures have gone through over 50 years or 100 years. And what is the benefit of that? But what's less studied is what's the cost of that? And it seems like convenience and more professional medical care makes sense, but there are these silent costs that happen where efficiency can replace effectiveness. And so you see things like a lot of depression in nursing homes, or like my parents told me, we really want to hold off going into a nursing home because basically the average lifespan is 2 years. People don't live past that, no matter what age they go in there. Wow. And I was like, whoa. Wow. Yeah. Like, it's a death sentence, you know? And you could say, oh, maybe it's because they're aging, but it's not a natural environment, so to speak, of what happens. So the other corollaries are, if you have, for men especially, there's these longitudinal surveys that say the more men have social relationships in their life, the longer they live. If they feel they need to work hard for their approval, or kind of, you know, limit their social connection to get more stuff done, they live shorter lives.
Yeah, that's interesting. And men, of course, don't build friendships and social networks as well as women do outside of the workplace.
Right. So when we look at the need for community gatherings, that's one of the needs, keeps our men alive. So, we don't have time for community gatherings. We don't see the indirect benefit of them. You know, and what are some examples of community gatherings? You know, I've spent a lot of time in other cultures, even here in the United States, Native cultures, asking the question of how do they raise their children? What is their worldview like when it comes to healthy human development? Because, you know, there's some phenomenal differences around worldview of what learning is and who people are and what nature is and what's important and what they prioritize. And it just creates a shocking contrast to the world I grew up in and the one that's currently unfolding around them here. And so, you know, one of the things that I see prioritized is when challenge comes to a certain family, a whole bunch of community people move towards it. And even if the people are unable to do anything about it. So if someone's having a baby, lots of people show up for that event. And there's a whole custom around how the mother gets seen, how the baby gets welcomed, the roles that other people have in caring for the home and the extended children that are there. And on the other end of the spectrum, when death happens in the community, it's a very troubling time, obviously, for the people closest to the one who died. But in an institutional, efficient world that we have, you know, around funeral homes and things, and the rapidity with which we have to accelerate a visitation and a obituary and dress up and play the part of host to all these other people coming, we've lost touch with what the grieving ritual has been through eons. And what happens in that environment in other communities is people come together and they just like slow down for multiple days, 4 days, 6 days, 9 days. And they sit with the body. They sit with the family members. Nobody's working, you know, or they're taking shifts. And people are feeding the family. And what's happening is we're catching up with the grieving, the acknowledgement that there's been a loss. And this is a very deep example, but when we don't have that on a regular basis, because other community members will revisit their losses, which is helpful. You know, it's like, oh yeah, I was sad when my parents died. I didn't get a chance to say goodbye to them. And they kind of revisit that story and people hear it. But if we have less and less and less and less and less and less of that, where does that cumulative grieving process go? How does it get folded back into families and workplaces? You know, maybe that's a kind of developmental trauma.
Yeah.
You know, that
so interesting.
We don't talk about death in this family. When your grandfather died, you know, we don't talk about him anymore. Who knows what happened, right? That can be lifelong issues. So that's an example I see happening. And the reverse is I see the benefits of bringing these gatherings back, both in community and in the workplace.
Yeah, and I think you're just getting the feel like after this pandemic, you know, concerts and parades or, you know, these bigger community events, it's just like they're just waiting to burst, you know, like mm-hmm. everyone wants to really get back into it, even though before maybe they didn't think of themselves as needing it as much as maybe they do now.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's so much great technology in community events that we could take a clue from and grow and be better at. One of them is music.
Absolutely.
And I think most people relate to music, you know, they have their playlists or their albums from the past and favorite artists. But at the community level, this is a cultural instrument in a sense that, for example, in the workplace, if there was a celebration that took place, or there was a challenge that took place, or there was an unspoken aspect of what took place in your team, music could actually come and facilitate movement, could facilitate naming the thing that's hard to talk about, and people can sing. And I've been working on this. This is like an edgy thing in terms of, you know, modern company cultures, but whenever we build enough trust and safety in the group, they have a profound experience of getting to know their coworkers like real human beings. And then they like them so much more and trust them so much more. Again, it's that indirect connection that builds more speed of trust in a sense, you know, where, oh, I trust the person, where I see more of who they are. And I went through something with them and I came out again and nothing bad happened.
I think music is just very powerful that way. I mean, in all cultures, I mean, music really does bring people together. I saw a quote the other day that says, music is what feelings sound like. And so, you know, it's just, yeah, it helps us bridge those gaps. It helps us understand each other at a different level. And yeah, there's not many people that say they don't like music.
Here's a little vignette. So I was working at Nike, and there was this team leadership development I was doing with this VP. And this was a group that, although they had all been there 10 or 15 or 20 years, had never experienced leadership development like we're talking about before, only training. And so we invited personal stories, gave them a little script, you know, talk about this, talk about that, you know, share a little piece about yourself, so we had get to know each other again. With this new VP coming in, it's like a reset. And so people did. And some of the stories were super vulnerable, you know. About one was, I had a death of a child, like an infant death syndrome story that was just super moving. And another was this woman who had cancer that had gone into remission and how she sees life because of that. Now this was just, people cried, you know, and we're like, but we're in a retreat space in a sense that it was a 3-day, you know, process. So it was okay. And as we got towards the end, I met one of the guys there, and he was telling me about his history, and we had some chats about it. He's like, oh yeah, I used to be part of a chorus. And I was like, oh, you used to be part of a chorus? He's like, yeah. I said, like a choral kind of facilitator? He's like, yeah. I said, like, you could actually facilitate people to sing who never sung before? He's like, yeah. And I was like, we're doing this. He goes, oh, no.
Oh, no. Wow.
I said, we're totally doing this. We had done a lot of great things. We included a couple of outdoor sessions that were super deep for people, and then a bunch of strategy sessions around how the org was going to start pivoting. But this thing was latent in the room, and I wanted to put a cap on the connection that took place there. So on the last day and the last kind of part of the hour, I worked with this guy, and we created a simple kind of musical end cap. It was hard. It was not even quite a song, you know. But it was the phrase gratitude for life. And we dedicated it to, you know, this woman and this guy. And so we got people to sing in 3-part harmony together and put their voices into this closing gratitude. That was something we had also instituted. We started doing gratitude every day. We opened and closed with it. So this is our musical version of it. And to hear them all coming together, right, and take the risk to be vulnerable but have this meaningful message dedicated to their coworker, it was so great. They're like, gratitude for life.
Oh, that's awesome. Wow.
It was beautiful. It was so great.
That's great. Well, let's dive into you know, leadership retreats a little bit. Do you feel they're effective in building teams and leaders, or are they just a good excuse to have fun? I mean, you know, I've seen both ideas. You had a lot of experience in this. So what do you think about retreats?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the aim is important. What is the aim? I have a leadership retreat coming up next week with a startup company that just got their funding, and they are choosing to go remote. They had to make a big choice with their small team. They're going to build a location or go remote, and they decided to go remote. So this is one of their in-person events in the year. So we have specific aims around what we want to get out of it. And having not met each other in person before, fun is an important piece, because all we do is work and all we do is see our face. So what is this person's body like, you know, when we run around and play games?
Right.
Something else is happening there they just would normally get in a community. You know, a community is like you get to see eight sides of a person, but through a video monitor at work, it's so limited. You don't quite have the sense of what that person can handle, what you can ask of them, other social connection, fun stuff you can take place during a work day so you can mix it up. So we're gonna open that up. But the intent for the day beyond that is to build a culture of trust through taking some risks together. And then we'll draw meaning from those events, not about the activity itself. Let's say, I don't know, we do a blindfold activity or navigate from A to B without a map. And that each person has a role. Well, there'll be some edges like that. But we'll ask, you know, how is this like the journey you're about to go on together? And what can we count on you for? Or what comes up for you when you're feeling scared? And what that does is it creates ownership of what's unspoken, and it creates empathy for those working with them. Oh yeah, I've got stuff like that too, you know. And then I give an empowering frame to it, you know, saying, so what's the best way for us to work with you as a team when you're under stress? And they get to say, well, what works for me is leave me alone. What works for me is say, hey, you look like you're a little stressed. And then they can let off some steam. So what that does is it really builds a foundation for performance, even though the activity looked like it was fun. That's really key for having a valuable offsite.
Yeah, that's interesting. As an executive coach, what is the most common thing that you see that executives struggle with?
Well, I don't know about most common, but I'll tell you ones that are really impactful is I've seen it play out two different ways. One executive who thinks they have to know everything and is impatient with allowing people to step into leadership. So they're driving things really hard. I would say kind of like running the engine too hot all the time. And it's knocking people off their center so regularly that they are confused and can't step into leadership. And so he ends up getting the opposite of what he's looking for.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
That's as a pattern is probably super common. What they need to work on is setting themselves up in a leadership learning environment where they are learning along with everyone else. Another executive, the CEO of the software company, she allowed herself to be one of the participants in our course. So I set up multiple retreats for the year, and we would start working on these kind of personal agency frameworks around how do we consider other people? What is the company asking of us? What is my role? What are some challenges I'm working on right now? And we created these learning processes where people would kind of ask them open-ended questions and listen, and they would get better and better at understanding themselves. She put herself into that process. And so it created a flat environment and a signal to say, this is okay to do. Whereas other executives who don't show up, don't want to show that vulnerability, don't want to be part of the learning process, it actually sends a total opposite message that this is not valuable.
Yeah,
so
that's a great point.
That's an issue, yeah. You know, that I think really needs to be worked on. When I do one-on-one work, I create contracts with the executives. I'm like, look, where is it you want to go? And you got to be involved in this process, at least in terms of not just ignoring it's going on the side, because people won't take it seriously.
Right. So you need to almost be an example of that you're willing to learn and grow and do this hard work. And if I do that, then the people that are part of your team are going to see that and say, I want to get on that train too. Yeah.
Exactly. It makes an enormous amount of difference. Because do you want your entire team growing and learning towards excellence? Or do you want to just try to cut corners and tell them what to do, right?
Yeah.
That's two different levels of performance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the key here, too, is sustainability. So, you know, we can all do demanding and high-intensity things for a short period of time. But how do you find that level of commitment without jeopardizing your career or coming off as someone who isn't willing to pay the price?
Mm-hmm. Hey, what do you mean by pay the price?
Well, it's kind of like, you know, if you start to put up some boundaries so that you don't burn out, and you, uh-huh. you don't run the engine too hot too long, and you start to cut back on that, and that could be perceived as, oh, well, this guy really mm-hmm. isn't, he's not reaching for the highest mm-hmm. level of success. So therefore, mm-hmm. People are afraid to maybe cut back because they're going to be mm-hmm. afraid they're going to be viewed as, oh, this guy isn't really going to work as hard as others. So therefore, he might not reach this high level.
Yeah, I love the question because it's probably a struggle a lot of people are in. But I would approach it from multiple perspectives just to, because we're talking hypothetical right now, right?
But right.
Is the company culture, and that could be just your division and your boss, one where they're really, the paradigm is one of extraction. They just want to extract all the value out of you. And therefore, competing to be at the top of the food chain is the effect of that. So, yeah, if you know, it's kind of like when I'm driving on the highway and it's rush hour traffic, and I'm like, God, this is way unsafe. You need five car lengths, you know, at this speed or something, right? So I slow down, and what happens? Another car zooms up on the wrong lane and pulls in front of me. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. So I back up again, and there it goes again.
You're right.
So the question is, do I want to be in this position, right? Because the two choices are kind of two sides of the same coin. I could compete and be putting my life at risk, or I could keep slowing down and other people are kind of getting in the way. So it's not an environment that's going to be thriving for me in either direction. So you have a choice at this point. And this is a good – I like that you brought this up because I want to take us out of the box of that problem and suggest that there is another paradigm that we can come from that creates more perspective and solution. So one, that paradigm, you know, is around extract value and you're a cog on the wheel. And that's like pretty well known in certain environments, cutthroat, competitive, but not all environments are like that, right? The next paradigm up is one that's a little reactive to that, which is about trying to regulate, create rules, and slow down chaos or arrest disorder. So it's got a lot of automatic and structured kind of things in there. And that might be something that you're trying to do, is I'm trying to arrest disorder in that environment. Another paradigm up from there is one that's not just in a stop action process, but it's in a generative process that's sensitive to all the changes that are going on. And in that environment, it's really looking to adapt, you know, create a lot of adaptation. And that might feel unstable, but it's certainly more sensitive.
Yeah.
The paradigm above that, that really is the one that shifts to a whole other level of operation, is a consciousness paradigm that is working to evolve the capacity of the whole system. So, you know, can you get out of this binary of either I compete and burn out, or I keep stepping back and don't thrive? And suggest that there is a way of working with a level up of the whole system to improve everybody's performance. Now, that's an invitation. Either you have a voice and a node in that system that you can press on, like an ally, or, you know, not like HR punitive kind of thing, but is your boss's boss helpful, or is it a lateral thing, or do you have to shift out of that department and go into another one? You know, depends on what your career path is like. But I think understanding that you don't have to be caught in a binary is a fundamental aspect of this. And then the other is, can I be a change agent in the system, or do I need to leave the system in order to have a better starting point of what I want for my life?
Yeah, that's a great way to explain it. Well, Mark, usually at this time in the interview, I always ask a common question, my guests, and that common question is, in relation to leadership, what is a pearl of wisdom that you could leave with us today?
Well, if I'm that guy who's at the top of that and I have some influence over my division or my company, what I'm interested in is creating an environment of learners who learn.
Yeah.
So the saying goes, you know, I can fish for you and you'll eat today. But that sets us in the cycle of them coming back needing to eat again, right? Or I can teach you how to fish and you'll eat for a lifetime. But still, that is only about you. If I want a culture that is regenerating new possibilities and adapting to change, there's a next level where we're creating a culture of people who are teaching others to teach.
Yeah. Amen. Yeah, that's awesome. Well, Mark, this has been a real pleasure sitting down with you today and talking about these concepts with leadership, and your experience is very interesting, and your perspective reflects that, I think. So thanks so much for giving us your time today and giving us some real ideas and things to think about, reflect on. So I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To listen to all my interviews, subscribe to Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and many other popular podcast platforms. Some of these interviews are on video, and you can search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also access the entire library of interviews on my website, orange.coaching.com, and that is orangethewordcoaching.com, and go to the Media Center and click on Podcasts or Video Gallery. You can also enter the website from pilpodcast.com.